With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese, Ryan Marine, and Dan Lloyd.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's weekly sports car racing podcast. In Daytona still, I'm Ryan Marine, joined by John DeGeese and Dan Lloyd as we break down the Rolex 24 at Daytona. Plenty to cover on the show this week, of course, with an interesting start, to say the least, and a wet one to the 2019 IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship season. We'll go class by class in a review of the Rolex 24 at Daytona here in just a little while. We've also got a lot of industry news that has come out post-Daytona to mull over as far as that's concerned. We've got an interview with Jordan Taylor, who is part of the overall winning driver lineup that I think you'll enjoy. And we'll wrap things up by answering listener questions and looking ahead to the Liqui-Moly Bathurst 12-hour. John will be headed down that way here relatively soon, and plenty to look forward to as another crown jewel event in the sports car racing calendar is coming up here fairly shortly. But guys, let's start with the Rolex 24 at Daytona, and before we dive into the classes, I think the first thing to address was the weather. It was the dominant storyline in a lot of respects. Great weather to start the race, and the first 12 hours were characterized by some intense racing on track, but I think some of that, too, was amplified by the fact that everyone knew rain was coming, and in a big way once we got to the overnight hours, and that's definitely what materialized. It had a huge impact on the race with two red flags, something that had never before happened in the history of the event, both of them for treacherous conditions on track due to the rain. So, John, I know you've been to a lot of these. How does this one compare from a weather perspective? Have you ever been to a Rolex 24 that was so dominated in terms of how the race played out to a large degree by Mother Nature?
No, from a personal standpoint, for sure, this was a first for me at the Rolex 24. I think this was my 11th or 12th. Watching them on TV in the early, mid to late 90s and early 2000s, I remember, I think 2004, that was the year that the Doran team from Bell Motorsports won the race. There was a really very long very long red flag period for rain, I think overnight, or fog or visibility. It was a challenging event, but this one was a little more straightforward in that regard, in that we just had rain, and it was more or less just flooding and track, the track was not raceable for a very long time. And I think, IMSA came under some criticism post-race by some drivers, by whether or not we should have gone back racing if it was raceable. And I think that they made the right calls. It looked, good. There was a lot of accidents, no doubt. But looking back at it, they were left in a really difficult situation because, you could have called the race with 8 hours to go. And what kind of headlines would that have brought? I give them kudos for getting the race back going. Okay, sure, the final 2 hours ended up being under red, but I still think that we saw a really good race, a different race in many regards.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I think IMSA and the Speedway both did everything in their power to try and ensure that as much green flag running occurred as possible. Yes, there were some accidents that occurred because of it. Thankfully, there were no major injuries. That's definitely good. Now, it's going to hurt the bottom line of a couple of teams, but ultimately, as Mark Raffoff told me after the race, racing in the rain's part of the package. And as far as I'm concerned, I think the series did the right thing. I don't think they compromised safety when they realized that the track was dangerous to be racing on. They threw the red flag, and I give them credit for that. How about you, Dan? Where do you come down on some of the criticism that has surfaced in the last couple of hours, whether or not it's criticism of the decision to throw the red flag or not race in the rain? Or also on the flip side, we saw some things on social media, people who wanted to see more green flag running and maybe less caution from the sanctioning body.
Well, you've got to remember that Daytona really is a completely different type of circuit to any other kind of track that sports cars race on. The banked oval particularly is a huge factor, and when you get any kind of rain on that, even light rain as we saw in first practice, that can cause some real problems. In the first practice session, some of the teams didn't go out at the start because you didn't really think there was much point in going out on a damp oval. And we also saw lots of puddles forming around some of the parts of the track. For the large majority of the race, I mean, there were raceable lines on the circuit away from these large puddle areas. But the banked oval is really still very difficult to drive on in these conditions. And while you might have been able to run a race in that kind of weather somewhere else, Daytona, you've got to just take that extra bit of precaution. And, you know, I echo John's thoughts. I applaud IMSA for running the race as long as they did. And I think we got the maximum green flag time. And when the race was green during the rain period on Sunday, we had some fantastic racing. And that is exactly what we want to see.
All right, with the weather discussion out of the way, let's jump into the various classes. We'll start with DPI. The headlines, many of them already, will read, Fernando Alonso wins the Rolex 24 at Daytona. He certainly deserves a fair share of the credit. He had a couple of really impressive stints. One comes to mind in the dry, John, where he was battling with Helio Castroneves, but his pace in the rain in particular, I think, is what caught a lot of people's attention, and Fernando's contributions to this lineup can't be overlooked, although Kamui Kobayashi, Wrenger Vanderzande, and Jordan Taylor, of course, also did their fair share of heavy lifting in the second Rolex 24 win in 3 years for the Wayne Taylor Racing team.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. And I think that Fernando seemed to be a man on the mission. I was extremely impressed with his race craft, his skill. You know, we all know he's a world-class driver, and we've seen him in the various sports car races he's done so far, the limited experience, relatively speaking. And I think his drive at Le Mans was very good. But I think this had to be probably his best drive yet in a sports car, taking the Wayne Taylor Racing Cadillac to the lead in the early hours in dry conditions, and then in the rain in the morning hours, really being in a league of his own. I've never seen anything like this. It almost looked like he was in a different class, in a different zip code, whatever you would call it. It was almost to the point where the team sort of realized this, and they were trying to maximize his drive time to make sure they can extract as much as possible in those conditions. They put Jordan Taylor in for a little bit after the first red. Wayne Taylor had been really pleading IMSA to throw a red flag in the first place because of the conditions. They were circulating behind the safety car, and the only thing I could keep on thinking in my mind was, there goes Fernando's drive time. You know, there's a maximum drive time of 4 hours in a 6 hour period, and here their best driver, who's by far and large the quickest driver in the wet at that time, was losing his drive time in the safety car. And so they couldn't pit because then they'd lose the position. So, and pit and change drivers because they would lose the position. So, you know, ultimately the red flag came out, the first one, and they were able to, you know, reshuffle it around, put Jordan in the car, have him do 2 hours, and then put Fernando in for the end. Ultimately, that paid off because he stayed extremely close to Felipe Nasr. The two had a really good battle in the wet. Ultimately, Felipe had a bit of a aquaplaning moment into turn one, and Alonso took the lead, and within seconds, I think the caution came out. So, and that was basically it. And so while a little luck played into the factor in the end, Fernando even said that in the post-race press conference, he still felt that they were the dominant force. And by looking at the stats, I think they led up more than 200 laps today. I think it was proven that the Wayne Taylor car was definitely the favorites, you know, of the race, and probably the well-earned victors.
And the end result is another Cadillac win in this crown jewel event. 3 years of the DPI platform and three Cadillac wins, two by this number 10 Konica Minolta car. So some impressive stuff from Wayne Taylor's operation, and this is what they are all about. They love this race. They prioritize this race. The championship matters, of course, but I think to a man, that lineup was there to win a Rolex, and that's what they did. The other big storyline outside of the overall win, I think, has to be what befell the Mazdas. They were so impressive with their pace in the build-up to the race itself, a track record in qualifying from the Mazda camp, and yet, in a very short span of time, all of a sudden, the Mazdas went from being very much in contention to being also Rans, and in one case, a DNF right then and there.
Yeah, it was quite shocking, really, how quickly the Mazdas tumbled out of contention. The 55 continued to turn laps, actually, after its original issue in the evening. So the 55 had an issue, and then the 77 had a more serious issue, which resulted in its retirement. The 55 continued, and it managed to get to within a lap of the other cars through the various safety car periods we had during the night. But then in the morning, Olivier Plat, who was behind the wheel, was hit by the four Corvette of Ollie Gavin, and the Mazda shut down, and that was it. Both of the Jost run cars had their days ended, which some people questioned the reliability of the Mazdas coming in, based on some previous form. But really, it was a great run up until that point. And I certainly think, at least for the sprint races, they're definitely looking good. I mean, the pace of the cars in the hands of all of the drivers, Ollie Jarvis in particular, René Rast had a great stint out front in the 77. They are a dangerous proposition, but there were plenty of superstars in this race. It's just a shame that sometimes the mechanical side of things doesn't work out and the drivers can't always show their full potential.
Yeah, and there were some other cars too that hit problems throughout the race, most notably the number 6 Acura that was definitely contending for the win in the dry. They had a alternator belt that came off, cost them a lot of time. It initially actually looked like an engine failure, but no, it just turned out to be an alternator belt. That car rejoined. Luckily, the sister car ended up getting on the podium, the number 7 of Ricky Taylor, Helio Castroneves, and Alexander Rossi. So good news for Acura Team Penske in that regard, but still, you know, what could have been had the race remained dry, I think we would have been looking at maybe a particularly different result.
Yes, I would agree. The Acuras just didn't seem to have the same pace once the rain came, especially relative to the Cadillacs, which absolutely came to life once the downpour began. Moving away from DPI and to LMP2, it was the number 18 Dragon Speed Orica that got the win there in kind of a strange finish to the race. John, I'll let you explain that in just a moment, but the driver lineup included Sebastian Saavedra, Ryan Cullen, Pastor Maldonado, and Roberto Gonzalez. They were absolutely elated post-race to be in a position to pick up a Rolex, albeit in a class that wasn't all that well subscribed. That being said, they'll still go down as class winners. But like I said, this one came in strange fashion. You almost had to see it to believe it.
Yeah, you know, just a few hours to go, they were running second in what appeared to be a Dragon Speed 1-2 in the race. The lead car, the pole-sitting car, ended up stopping on track with a loose wheel, and this car took over the lead. I don't know who was in it at the time, but the big moment, as you mentioned, Ryan, came when Sebastian Saavedra was at the wheel. A little under 2 hours to go, he lost control of the car, made heavy contact into the barriers. That ended up bringing out the final caution of the race, which led to the race-ending red flag. We weren't sure what was going to happen with this car because they had a four-lap lead at this point over the Performance Tech Orica in second. Luckily, Sebastian ended up getting it back together, driving it back to the pits, and that was extremely crucial because had the car gone back on a wrecker, it may have lost those four laps by the time the race was called, you know, by the time the race went red. So extremely quick reaction there by the Elton Julian-led team. Luckily, there wasn't too much damage. The car had been damaged before in some incidents. Sebastian actually said in the post-race conference, I think they went through three different noses through the race, and it was a really war of attrition in LMP2. We had another car knocked out early. Mark Kwame in the PR1 Matheson car spun and got hit by one of the JDC Miller Cadillac DPIs early on in the race, and so that sort of knocked one out right away. Then it sort of came into Dragon Speed's dominance through the night, and they were really running to a pattern until Hendrik Hedman's unfortunate stoppage on track. But still, nonetheless, a great result for these guys. This was the WEC spec LMP2 car converted to IMSA configuration for this weekend, obviously. But great to see these guys. And also, it's Pastor Maldonado's first win as a sports car driver. So while many people are sort of basking in the highlights of Fernando Alonso winning at the Rolex 24, here we have another, you know, fairly high profile F1 star getting his first win in sports cars altogether.
Yeah, those were some of the positives to take away from the weekend. And what ultimately was something of a forgettable weekend for the LMP2 class. And again, we're hopeful that we'll see some more cars on the grid on a full season basis, but kind of have to wait and see on that point. Still just the two confirmed beyond Sebring at this point. How about GT Le Mans? We'll go to you on this one, Dan. This was the class that you were most focused on towards the end of the race. An emotional win, to say the least, for BMW. A couple of thoughts spring to my mind in addition to the emotions associated with this, and you can touch on that. Also, think about how far this BMW program has come in a year, pretty much a year removed from looking almost hopeless in their debut event at the Rolex 24 with this car, to this point where they can win. The other thing I think of is the three of us, our consensus in our preview show was basically any of the manufacturers bar BMW we felt pretty confident in. And look at this, by the end of 24 hours, the BMW package looked extremely strong, especially in the wet.
Yep, I think we'll put our hands up and say that we didn't see that one coming. The number 25 BMW was a real joker in the pack. It didn't lead too much, actually. It was sort of hanging around the top five or in the top three for most of the race, but it didn't really have any extended stays out front. But it led at the most important time, and that was when the red flag came out right at the end. It didn't look to be the case that the 25 would be in the lead. There was a strange quirk in that the 67 Ford, which Richard Westbrook was driving, was originally in front. But he did a mammoth stint. He stayed out during a caution when everyone else pitted and did a ridiculous number of laps. I can't remember exactly how many, but he ended up pitting in the full course yellow that occurred just before the red flag, which meant essentially there was a free passage for the next car behind to go through and take the win, and that was the 25 BMW of Augusto Farfus, which was also driven by Conor DeFilippi, Philipp Eng and Colton Herta. Farfus, I would say, was probably the standout in that car. He really, really turned the wick up in the final awnings of the race. He made the crucial pass on James Gallardo in the Rizzi Competizione Ferrari, which completely changed the outcome. I mean, the Ferrari had been looking really strong in the wet, but Farfus pushed and pushed and closed the gap down and managed to get past, and that turned out to be the crucial moment. So it was a very, very gritty win. It was a win that BMW has been searching for a long time, and it was the kind of victory that I think Charlie Lamb probably would have been extremely proud of.
Yeah, it was a bit of a subdued weekend for sure for the BMW family with the news of Charlie Lamb's passing, the longtime Schnitzer team principal, on Thursday. And I think maybe that gave the team a little bit more motivation to have a solid result, especially a lot of those drivers that have driven for Charlie's organization, including Augusto. Farfus got his big win in the FIA GT World Cup just a few months ago in Charlie's final race as a team principal prior to his planned retirement. So all around, I think this was a huge win for BMW. You know, just 12 months after the debut of the M8 GTE, it struggled in some championships, in WEC particularly. And I know, you know, there's a lot of politics and whatnot going on over there, but to see the success and to see that the Rahal team and BMW really sink their teeth into it over in IMSA, and I think this sort of proved that, you know, this package works, they can succeed, and if they have some talented drivers behind the wheel, as in the case to Farfus, who, let's remember, he was a last-minute addition. You know, he wasn't planned to do this race until Tom Blomqvist ran into visa problems, and Augusto was called up at the last minute. So imagine, you know, had the race stayed dry for prototype, we might have had a different winner. Had Tom Blomqvist's visa been processed, it might have been a different outcome as well. So really interesting implications there. But nonetheless, we see BMW as the 2019 GTLM class winners at Daytona.
And very well deserved. I think Colton Herta also deserves a shout out. He actually set the race's fastest lap in that class, which I'm not sure anybody was predicting coming in. Colton himself, I saw him actually get out of the car following the stint in which he set that lap, and I can attest to just how excited he was, and again, well deserved for him and for that whole team. Something they can definitely build on, looking forward to the rest of the WeatherTech Championship season. GT Daytona saw back-to-back wins for the Grasser Racing team. Really impressive stuff, especially when you consider the hole that this Lamborghini team dug for itself in the early going. Two pretty massive penalties, one a drive-through, and then one a 3-minute, 40-second stop and hold for improper wave-by really early on. Effectively buried this car deep in the field to the point where I had pretty much forgotten they were there. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, they show up in the top five. Next thing you know, they're fourth, and then they're third. And then Christian Engelhardt and Mirko Bortolotti turned in some really good stints overnight and got that car right up there in contention. Engelhardt, in particular, was very stout in the waning moments of actual green flag racing. As the conditions reached their most treacherous and several of the front runners hit trouble, including Lucas Stoltz in the number 33 Mercedes-AMG Team Riley Motorsports car. He was leading at one point. It went off track. Same can be said for Daniel Morad, who was an absolute missile in the wet in the number 29 Land Monteplace by Land Motorsport Audi. He also went off track in turn one. Both of them, while leading, they conceded those positions, and the beneficiary was this GRT team and Engelhardt, who kept it together when conditions were the most challenging and was in position then when the race was ultimately red flagged and never resumed to pick up another win. And it's so interesting to compare this year's win for GRT to last year's. The races couldn't have been a whole lot more opposite, with so much clean running a year ago and effectively none once you got past the halfway point in this year's edition of the Rolex 24. It made for a stark contrast. And speaking with Gottfried Grasser after the race, he said it was basically two different worlds, the win last year and the win this year. He was clearly over the moon with the accomplishment, told me in no uncertain terms this was the single greatest achievement for his team in its existence, and I think that's saying something. Pretty remarkable. Three of the four drivers in the lineup, they were part of the driver lineup last year too, so all of a sudden guys like Rick Broekers and Rolf and Eiken are two-time winners of the Rolex 24, and they do so in successive years. All in all, it was a fascinating race for the GTD class. It was wide open with as many as 10 cars still on the lead lap, fairly late in the green flag running at least. Got whittled down a little bit in the final moments, but like I said, a really interesting and captivating race for the GT Daytona cars, and a bit of history there too with this Grasser Racing team coming over and winning in consecutive seasons.
Yeah, and it's also coming with the debut of the Lamborghini Huracan GT3 Evo. This was the first ever race with this upgrade kit to this car. Obviously, and I think in the case of Grasser and the Ebbe Motors Lamborghinis, these were upgraded cars. The other Lamborghini competitors had all brand new cars. Didn't make a big difference. Obviously, didn't have an impact at all in the race, but I think it shows the strength of this package that the Italian manufacturers put together. But like you said, Ryan, a really competitive field. We saw the Meyer Shank Racing Acura up front for quite a while. AJ Allmendinger leading, I believe, in every single one of his appearances now with the MSR team for the last 13 years out of, I think, 13 out of 14 years or something of the consecutively. So really incredible stuff there. And also hats off to the Lexus guys for getting a podium at Daytona in the AIM Vassar Sullivan team's debut with the RCF GT3 coming home third. So that's a really good result for those guys as well.
There's obviously a whole lot more to say about each of these four classes. With it being a 24-hour race, there was no shortage, even though the race was shortened to some degree, or at least we didn't see green flag running for 24 hours. Nevertheless, there was a lot of drama, a lot of interesting twists and turns that we simply don't have the time for here. So check out all of our recap stories and reaction pieces as well at sportscar365.com if this has whet your appetite. Let's take a break, and when we return, we've got a lot of industry news to get to as well. Plenty of important dignitaries from the world of sports car racing on site at Daytona International Speedway this weekend. We talked to many of them, and some interesting thoughts on several topics we'll get to next on the Double Stint Podcast.
Hi guys, I'm Christian Fittipaldi, and you're listening to Sports Car 365 Double Stint Podcast.
We'll be right back. Back on Double Stint, let's get to the news of the week. Much of this coming from the Rolex 24 at Daytona event. John, let's start with some more on the latest DPI rumors, or maybe more than rumors in some cases. Where do we stand with other manufacturers potentially interested in joining the ranks? I know if you've listened to our special report episodes, we've discussed at least in one the potential interest and planning, really, that's going on from the Ford camp, and you can weigh in greater detail on that. But there's another manufacturer that's at least testing the waters and trying to evaluate whether or not an entry into DPI might be worth doing.
Yeah, it's emerged that BMW is evaluating the DPI platform. Speaking to Jens Marquardt during the Rolex 24, he confirmed that they're in the discussions for the new generation of DPI. He stressed that they're still at the extremely early stages. There's no plan in place. There's no, you know, I don't think there's even a real serious evaluation right now, but they're just sort of keeping their options open, seeing what's out there, and very much like he sort of compared it to what they've been doing with the ACO hypercar regs. You know, they've been sitting in those meetings and seeing where it develops. And I think it's safe to assume that we're not going to see a BMW in the hypercar regs. I think BMW has its sights set on more alternative technology with hydrogen that could be on the horizon that's actually planned for the ACO in 2023. And I believe that's one of the reasons why BMW is taking an interest in hypercar for now. Whether or not a DPI program will materialize, it remains to be seen. But I think this is the clearest indication yet that, you know, BMW is interested in DPI. But that does leave the question, what happens to the GTE program we just saw win the Rolex 24? Could they do both? Could it be an either or? Could the DPI be a customer program? We're not entirely sure just yet. That was one of the talking points through the weekend at Daytona, was customer DPIs. I ended up finding out that the Nissan DPI is available for sale beyond the cars that Core Autosport has. Speaking to Pierre Nicolet from the newly renamed Ligier Automotive, he confirmed that they can build a car, I think, in 6 to 8 weeks. So anybody wanting to go out and run a DPI, you know, later this year, it's a pretty easy entry point to all of a sudden go up and show up and make a statement. And the other interesting piece of news on the Ford front is that we've heard that their initial DPI entry, should it happen for 2020, may end up being a customer program and not a full factory effort. And also, you know, finally, I don't think we should be forgetting about Honda either. They made their presence this weekend in the Michelin Pilot Challenge. Had a challenging debut in that race, but there were some executives here from Hyundai, you know, taking a look at the motorsports landscape, and we continue to hear that they're interested in DPI. So 2-3, you know, potential new manufacturers for as early as 2020. It's pretty incredible to see the growth of this platform just in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and I think there's a lot of optimism surrounding DPI looking towards the future. But what comes next after DPI? That, too, has been a major talking point. Where do we stand? What do we know about the direction that the 2022 regulations might be taking based on discussions that were held at Daytona this week?
Well, in one word, I would say hybrid. It's basically a general consensus between all the manufacturers I spoke to. They've said they want some sort of hybridization in the new regulations. And I think that's sort of forecasting ahead of seeing where the automotive market will be in 3 years' time, 3 or 4 years' time, when these new regulations come fully online. And speaking to Mark Rushbrook from Ford, he said that's one of the selling points for them. They need to make an impact in that market, whether it be an EV or a hybrid powertrain. Speaking to Jens Marquardt from BMW, he also agreed that hybrid is very important for BMW if they were to enter DPI. And speaking to IMSA President Scott Atherton in the past, he's given strong hints towards a hybrid future in this new platform, whatever it may be called. Probably DPI, maybe it may stay DPI, we don't know. Anyway, it seems like the consensus is that it's a but very much so an affordable turnkey system, perhaps a very single supplier specification system to sort of reduce costs. I know the ACO and FIA have made cost-cutting measures for their new hypercar regulations, especially on the ERS systems, but I think what IMSA is looking to do is take it even one step further and make sure that teams can afford it, keep the budgets under control, and maybe only marginally increase the current operating cost of DPI, which, from what I can tell, is still less than a GTE budget. So when you look at the likes of BMW or Ford, they go make the switch to DPI, they may actually end up saving them money. And that begs the question, what happens to GTE? And I guess that's for another episode.
Transitioning away from IMSA for just a moment, we've been tracking this story in previous episodes, trying to figure out what car count might look like, what the status really of Blancpain GT World Challenge America, looking ahead to the season, which kicks off in March at Circuit of the Americas. And we do have some more intelligence as far as that's concerned. We've been doing a little bit of digging, trying to figure out which cars might be on the grid, which teams might be fielding these cars. And a couple of things have actually come to light here recently. So let's get an update on what we know first, John, and then what might we speculate we might learn a bit more about here in the next week or two.
Yeah, there's been a flurry of news lately in terms of what the grid will look like for Blancpain GT World Challenge America. And we had the first domino to fall last week with K-Pax Racing confirming its lineup. Relatively unchanged in terms of drivers, all four of those drivers returning: Alvaro Parent, Maxime Soule, Andy Suchek, and Rodrigo Baptista. Obviously, this championship now turns into a full Sprint X kind of style series, 90 minutes in length, two drivers with pit stops and actually refueling for the first time. So we'll be seeing all four of those drivers for the entire championship in new generation Bentleys. Additionally, we have P1 Motorsports that's now in the planning, finalizing stages of a Mercedes GT3 program with JC Perez, and most likely paired up with a Mercedes AMG factory driver. They're expanding outside of their additional their originally confirmed IMSA program with the Mercedes. They've purchased a third chassis that they'll be dedicated for World Challenge competition, which is great to see. There's going to be at least three other Mercedes on the grid, we understand, and also up to six Porsches. That sort of came as a shocker when I spoke to Daniel Armbruster from Porsche Motorsport North America over the weekend, and he said that it looks like to be the case. We know of at least, I think, five, it looks like, right now. It's probably safe to assume we'll see the likes of Allegra, Wright, GMG back. How many cars each team fields and what the caliber of the lineup is, I think, remains to be seen. I think a lot of things are going on behind the scenes. We don't want to speculate too much, but for sure, I think this grid is going to be bigger than what we saw last year, and I think it's going to come extremely close to Stefan Reitel's target of 20 cars, which is going to be great to see.
Yeah, definitely a lot more optimism about car count in the series here this week, even than when we were sitting around trying to figure this out last week. I think the last few weeks, though, in general, there has been some movement to get some programs announced, or at least close to being announced, and that has us excited about the season to come. Finally, there has been some speculation about whether or not Corvette Racing might make another appearance in the FIA WEC in the upcoming round at Sebring. We know they're going to be on site already with their two IMSA cars, and whether or not an additional car or chassis to some degree would be available to run in the 1,000-kilometer race that precedes the 12-hour race. That's been kind of a logical thought if Corvette was looking to extend its footprint into the WEC just a little bit further, and it sounds like that's the direction that it's headed with potentially 1C7R set to take the start at Sebring.
Yeah, it's appearing more and more likely that we're going to see a Corvette on the grid in the WEC race at Sebring, which would, of course, be a fantastic addition. Not the first time that the US manufacturer has joined the grid this season. We understand that if Corvette does commit to an entry, which it has yet to do, there's nothing confirmed at this point, but if it does commit to an entry, it would likely be the number three lineup, since the number four driver lineup, which usually races in IMSA, competed in the Shanghai 6 Hours in November. So Corvette, it's an exciting time for World Endurance Championship fans because the Corvettes are of course always welcome. The sound, the rumble of the V8 is an iconic sound, and it certainly has a place on WEC grids. So it looks like this could be something that Corvette might be working towards. The manufacturer is certainly interested in it. I think we've spoken to a few members of Corvette staff over the last few weeks and couple of months, and they seem to be keen on the idea, but it's all got to be confirmed at the top, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that very, very soon.
Well, with that, let's get to our next break, and then a guy who's been a part of the Corvette racing lineup before, Jordan Taylor, will be joining us to talk about his most recent triumph at the Rolex 24 at Daytona, his famous teammates, and a whole lot more. That's next on Double Stint.
Hi, this is Renger van der Zande. You're listening to Sports Car 365 Double Stint Podcast.
Jordan Taylor, kind enough to join us now on the Double Stint Podcast, hot on the heels of his second Rolex 24 at Daytona win in the last 3 years, this time teaming with Renger van der Zande, Fernando Alonso, and Kamui Kobayashi with the Konica Minolta Wayne Taylor Racing team. Like I said, Jordan, quite the streak for you, two in the last 3 years, although there was a frustrating race kind of in between there, looking back to last year's Rolex 24 at Daytona. How significant, though, is this achievement for you and the team to take the crown jewel event two times in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I think if you look at the whole grid as it's in itself, the level of competition with, you know, Team Penske coming last year, you know, Yost coming in with Mazda, Nissan's there, all the big manufacturers. So for a little team like Wayne Taylor Racing to be fighting against the big factories like that, I think is incredible. And to win two out of three, like you said, is a huge accomplishment. So I think it's a big testament to what my dad's built at Wayne Taylor Racing over the past few years, and really proving to everyone that he's built a proper team with amazing people.
Do you still look at yourselves as the little team or the underdog against some of these, or do you think some of the success that you've had over the years has changed that perception?
I think people look at us as a very big team, but I think if you actually look deep into it, you know, it is still a small team. You know, we have no, you know, it's not a factory team like a Yost or a Penske team. My dad's still out finding sponsorship. We have Konica Minolta as our title sponsor. And, you know, we don't have tons of personnel at the shop. We have a small group of guys that are incredible at what they do. We've had a good core group for the past few years, and I think that's really a big part of our what's brought our success, especially when we transitioned from the Daytona prototype to the DPI Cadillac. Wayne Taylor Racing had a huge part in developing that whole process with Dallara and ECR and Cadillac to get this car off the ground. And we actually, you know, as a team, we kind of gave up our last year in 2016 in the DP to start helping develop the new Cadillac for the future. So I think it's nice to have this success after all the hard work they've done.
Well, certainly a small group, but definitely had you prepared for some very difficult conditions over the course of 24 hours of racing. It seemed like it was almost two different races, the first half and the second half, when the rain started to come down. How much of a compromise did you guys make on the setup going into the race, knowing that there was a chance for some pretty torrential rain, which ultimately is what we saw?
Yeah, it was unbelievable weather change throughout the race, but I think for us, we knew there was rain coming, but at the same time, it was hard to know what to do from a setup point of view because we had never driven on the new Michelin in the wet. I don't think anyone had. So we didn't know what the car needed, what the tire needed to work properly in the wet. So for us, we knew it was going to be cold. So every time there was a cold session, we kind of made the most of that in the roar to try to maximize the setup to understand what made the car work a little bit better in the cold conditions. And I think we saw that in the race where, you know, we started off decent. And as soon as the sun went down, the temperature dropped and the car came to life and we were able to drive to the front. And when the rain came, somehow our car came to life again and was extremely strong. So it was definitely a race of survival and attrition. And we knew that And, you know, we kept telling all the drivers that, you know, you can do whatever you want in the first 20 hours. Just make sure you're not taking any risk and you're staying on the lead lap. It doesn't matter if you lose 20 seconds on one lap. We can make it back under yellow. So it was just about getting to that rain portion of the race in contention and then starting the fight.
Did you get a sense for what specifically your Cadillac was doing better than some of your competitors when the rain came? Where were you strong relative to the folks that you were battling for the lead with?
It was hard to tell. You know, there was so much rain. When I got in the wet, it was after the first red flag. So there was still a lot of standing water and spray. So when I got to the lead, I passed to Ronnie. It just seemed like he was struggling overall to get the car working in the wet. And he just didn't seem that comfortable. So I knew I needed to attack and get by him so I could at least see where I was going. And once I had clear track, it was so much easier to drive. And I think that was the key to just being able to pull a gap. And then later on when it dried out, it seemed like our car wasn't as strong in those intermittent conditions where the track was kind of just damp. But either way, it was, I think we the guys did a great job with the setup. Obviously, it was fast in the dry and the wet. And that's what you need for a 24-hour race.
What was harder, driving in those wet conditions or sitting around waiting the last 2 hours trying to figure out if the race was going to resume?
Yeah, I think when it was really wet, it was sketchy to drive. It was definitely not enjoyable, especially going into turn one with all the standing water, coming out of turn six and out of the bus stop. It was just, you were basically going through a giant puddle and hoping that the car didn't spin and trying to keep it straight. But yeah, definitely that when that second red flag came out, it was kind of so long. I think it came out with like 2 hours to go, so it was such a long time to the end of the race. It seemed like it would have to go back to green given that much time. But every time we looked at the radar, it was getting worse and worse over that 2 hour period. So we figured if they went red, you know, at that point, they'd be crazy to go back green. With it just getting worse and worse, especially with the cars not even on track, cleaning off the water as it was coming down. Every time the car sat in pit lane, you know, all those puddles would build up even faster. And we kind of figured with an hour to go, it would be tough for them to restart because they need us. They had to give us 20 minutes to warm the cars back up. And once we got back to that like 30 minutes to go, I think we started feeling a little bit more comfortable. But everyone just kept joking around that, you know, we were going to have to go back green, and I was just glad Alonso was going to have to be the guy to do it, not me.
What was it like up on the box, all of you guys there together, trying to figure out what was going to happen? Did you keep it loose? Was it pretty tense? Can you take us through what the final couple hours were like as you, like the rest of us, were sitting around waiting to figure out what your fate was going to be, essentially?
Yeah, even at the first red flag, it was weird. I was sleeping when it came out, and then Fernando wanted me to get woken up to talk about the rain conditions since I had some experience there at Daytona about standing water. So I got woken up and I came to the pits, and I had no idea there was even a red flag. And when I got there, it was just all kind of confusion because I don't even know how much time, there was like 6 hours to go still, and they weren't even sure if they were going to restart at that point. And then once we kind of got through that period to the next red flag, it was kind of, we were all assuming that they'd want some sort of spectacular finish. So they were going to try to go green. So some guys were joking around because they felt like it would be no way to go green again. But I think in the back of everyone's mind, everyone was pretty stressed that they'd want to go green again. And if that was the case, you'd just be trying to survive those last few laps. So I think it was pretty stressful. I think Fernando was definitely, you know, he didn't want it to go back green, not just because we were in the lead, but because he knew how difficult it was.
Yeah, that was apparent from watching as well. Well, ultimately, it did not go back to green. You end up taking the overall win. A perfect way to start the season from a championship perspective as well. Have you given that a whole lot of time, you and Ranger, what this win does for you looking at the entirety of the championship, or have you just focused on celebrating the achievement that you were able to add over the weekend?
Yeah, no, even when that first red flag came out, or that second red flag came out, you know, Bringer and I and the engineer were all talking, and even at that point we said, no matter what happens, it's a much better start to the year than we had last year. We had that DNF last year at Daytona, and we ended up losing the championship by 6 points, and that's only a couple positions. So for us, even just finishing on the podium would have been a huge step in the right direction compared to last year. So getting the win, you get those extra bonus points that separate you from the rest of the field for a win. So it's definitely a great start. Obviously, it couldn't have gotten any better, and gets us kicked off on the right foot.
No doubt about it. Well, thank you very much for the time on the show. I know you've been awfully busy with various commitments after winning the race, but we do appreciate hearing from you, and we'll see you in a little over a month down in Sebring, all right?
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Ryan.
Hi, this is Jordan Taylor, and you're listening to Sports Car 365's Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint, let's get to a listener question that came in on Twitter. It comes from @MavTasticRaceIn, who wants to know, what's the story with Rebel Rock, the Michelin Pilot Challenge team? Why is there no second Camaro? They bought two cars and announced their intention for a two-car effort for this season. What can you say, John?
Well, it's pretty simple, and it basically comes down to budget. I spoke to Robin Liddell, who's kind of a co-team principal over there, I'd have to say. He's sort of managing the program and also acting as a driver. And he said that they're hoping to have a second car, possibly later in the year, but they need funded drivers. Right now, it's a pro-am pairing with him and team owner Frank Depew. And there was an intention to have the second car on the grid, but funding didn't materialize. So if somebody has some money out there, wants to go drive a Corvette, I think they have a good co-driver in Andrew Davis ready to step up to sit in that seat. So fingers crossed we can get that car on track and maybe add to the further diversity and growth of the GS class.
Unfortunately, the team had a tough debut in the Daytona round. They were out really, really early in that race, which is a shame, and hopefully that's not a setback. But yeah, speaking with Robin last year, going back to Petit Le Mans, I think he made it pretty clear at the time the goal was to run the two cars, but it's all, of course, contingent on finding the funding to do so, and hopefully we do see a second Camaro on the grid at some point later on in the year. Finally, let's wrap it up, John and Dan, by previewing the Liqui Moly Bathurst 12-hour. John, as we record this, you're about to take off tomorrow to make the trip down to Australia. One of the events you look forward to most in the racing calendar. What has you excited about this year's edition?
Well, there's always a great grid at Bathurst. It's always a great atmosphere, and this one is definitely going to be no different. 41 cars on the entry list, and it also doubles again as the Intercontinental GT Challenge season opener. And we've seen an incredible amount of growth in this championship for this year. BMW's joined the grid. We've had a Nissan representation with KCMG. We have additional entries from Mercedes AMG making an even larger commitment this year alongside returnees Audi and Porsche and Bentley. So lots of talking points, lots of top drivers. I think there's 20 drivers coming from the Rolex 24 to Bathurst 12-hour, and Dan actually spoke to the folks at Black Swan Racing, which is one of two teams actually pulling double duty between different chassis, but flying their crew across the Pacific as well to get to this race. So really looking forward to it. It's always a great start to the GT racing season, per se, in terms of those marquee events where GT cars battle for the overall wins. And, you know, not discounting Dubai by any factor, but I think Bathurst has sort of gotten into a league of its own in terms of the prestige and level of factory involvement. So really should be a great event, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, Bathurst is always a race that I put into my diary as soon as I buy one at the start of the year. It really is one of those marquee events, and as you said, John, the lineup is just brilliant, really, across the board. The GT3 field, especially, so many GT3 cars and different manufacturers involved. The top the top teams are from around the world as well. I mean, we've got teams that have won the big endurance races before. Valkenhorst Motorsport, the defending Spa 24 Hours winners. We've got KCMG coming over. We've got BMW team Schnitzer. No doubt that will be a very significant occasion for the team for reasons previously mentioned in this show. And yeah, really, it's just a massive festival for GT3 racing and an opportunity as well to see some what we could call previous generation GT3 cars to race, and we might not see them too much after this. The Aston Martin Vantage GT3 is going to be replaced for 2019, and we've also got McLaren 650S, which has wowed crowds on the mountain in previous years. So yeah, plenty for the fans trackside to spot, and by all accounts, from what John's told me, the weather's going to be very nice as well, so should be a fantastic weekend of racing.
Well, we will be breaking down this year's edition of the Bathurst 12 Hour on our next edition of the Double Stint Podcast. Safe travels to you, John, and Dan, we'll be seeing you down the road as well. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'd love a rating and a review on iTunes. Please check out our new daily podcast as well, weekdays. It is our daily digest, 2 to 3 minutes, all the headlines from the previous day, or in the case of Mondays, from the previous weekend. I think you'll like the format. It should deliver the news to you in a nice, condensed, and easy-to-digest method. We'd also like to let you know that you can now listen to Double Stint and also the Daily Digest on your Amazon Alexa or Google Home smart speakers. For details on how to do that, check out sportscar365.com and also sportscar365.fm, which also hosts our podcast network. For John and for Dan, thank you again for joining us on this week's show. We'll talk to you next week with a recap of the Bathurst 12 Hour here on Double Stint.